As Lord Krebs has said, I have the responsibility for trying to introduce the broad ethical evaluative framework for our report. But my remarks are intended to be only part of the story. Professor Brownsword, who will follow me, will, in his remarks, fill out the story that I'm starting. Okay. So we start not so much with ethics, but with political philosophy, which I take, in fact, to be a branch of moral philosophy. And we have to start from some very brief, very abstract remarks about the conception of the state. So here's one conception, it's often called the libertarian conception, according to which the state's role is just to protect the rights of the individual. On that conception of the state has pretty minimal responsibilities with respect to public health. You can contrast that with a collectivist perspective of the role of the state, according to which the main goal of the state is to achieve certain collective ends. Famously for the utilitarian, it would be the greatest happiness of the greatest number, but we can just think of these as the general welfare. And if you took that view of the role of the state, then clearly public health is very prominent among the proper goals of the state. But the collectivist position can be interpreted to take the view to imply that these collective goals override any concern with the individual rights that the libertarian is so keen to protect. So, in between these two end positions, it's common to talk of liberal positions as positions which seek to combine both protection for individual rights, but also the pursuit of general ends, general welfare, including public health. And that's the broad area that most modern states occupy, and that's the territory that we now want to try to explore. So the issue is really to explore the conflict between, on the one hand, the promotion of public health as an aspect of general welfare, but on the other hand, the protection of individual freedoms and rights. And one philosopher who famously had a very distinguished attempt to do this was John Stuart Mill, who formulated the principle known as the harm principle. I won't read it out loud to you. Most of you probably will have encountered it already. But the basic thought is that the state's role is mainly to protect us from doing harm to each other. And it's the last sentence there that also, though, is worth quoting. The individual's own good, either physical or moral, is not a sufficient warrant for the state's intervention. So if we take it that health is a good, we then take it that Mill is implying that one's own health, either physical or moral, is not a sufficient warrant for the intervention by the state, by itself. And that would lead to, if we took that as our guiding model for the combining the state's power and the state's activity in promoting public goods on the one hand, but on the other hand, respecting individual freedoms, that would give us the following kind of framework. So on the one hand, it's the state's responsibility to reduce the risks that we pose to each other, say in respect of infectious diseases, or again, in respect of sewage. And equally, and this is the point that I didn't mention with respect to Mill, that it is the state's role to be particularly active in trying to protect the interests of children because they're not fully responsible for themselves. But that public activity is constrained by the requirement that one should avoid coercion, the coercive attempt to make people lead healthy lives. Okay, so that gives you one way of approaching this issue. But as we deliberated around this matter, it came to seem to us that that really was not entirely satisfactory. And so there's a range of issues where we felt that that classic liberal framework was not adequate to the requirements that public health policy needs to address. Take the topic of consent. Now, it's clearly central to the liberal framework that importance be attached to individual consent. And, of course, consent has played a major part in medical ethics, particularly since the Second World War. And yet, it seemed to us that too much attention can sometimes be placed upon consent. For example, if one's engaged in epidemiological work, it may well be the case that if you start asking for people's consent, for example, when you're gathering blood spots from newborn children, you find that significant numbers of people don't give consent, and then the epidemiological surveys that you want to undertake, their value becomes significantly undermined because you're instead of getting sort of 95%, you're getting less than 80%. And yet, how important is it that consent be obtained for this work, since the results are entirely anonymized? Again, it's not clear that the liberal framework fully addresses the importance of inequalities of health. I'm afraid we have to be well aware of the fact that although some inequalities of health are, of course, unproblematic, it's scarcely fair for men to complain about the fact that women have a longer life expectancy than men. That's not an inequality that we can do anything about. But on the other hand, the very well-attested connections between socioeconomic differences and life expectancy and other forms of disease and disability, those are, in a way, a scar on our society. And it must be part of the state's responsibility to try to do something to address them. Again, if we reflect on recent experience, although the liberal will emphasize the importance of education and persuasion and public programs to get people to change their habits, for example, with respect to wearing seatbelts when they're in cars or with respect to smoking, we're also, I'm afraid, have to be well aware that these programs didn't turn out to be altogether effective. And once there was a strong public consensus in their favor, then a certain amount of further intervention or regulation didn't seem to be very oppressive. So it seems to us, that the importance to each of us of being a member of a community in which we take a general, an individual interest in the state of public health and the health of our fellow citizens, including those who we may not regularly meet, but equally in the use of public spaces and other facilities, that value was not being properly captured by the liberal model that we were thinking about. However, that did not motivate us to think that we ought to adopt a much more intrusive or paternalist approach associated with this phrase, the nanny state, that it was the state's business actually to go marching into people's private houses and telling them what they could eat, what they could drink, and how they should bring up their children. That was not the approach that we favored at all. Instead, we favored what John mentioned, the stewardship model. This phrase stewardship comes to us from particularly the WHO. Further back, actually, interestingly, it comes from the theology of man's relationship with nature. So the thought that man is a steward of nature, that thought was launched somewhere back in the 1960s, and that's, I think, the source of this conception of the stewardship relationship. And that, so the stewardship model, then, is the thought that the state is to be the steward of public health. And if one takes that approach, then it looks as though one can have a more energetic or more proactive role for the state in respect of public health. So the first two goals there are largely the same as those implied by Mill's classic liberal principle, but the last three are ones, in a sense, we want to add on as we give the state this further stewardship role, but we do that without reducing the importance we attach to the constraints that were there before. So we take it that the state has this stewardship role, this responsibility for public health, but it's not the state's business, as I say, to make people healthy. Now, in thinking about the way in which that those goals are to be implemented, plainly the main player, well, one major group of players are medical institutions like hospitals, schools, and medical charities. And one may take it, I think, that these are institutions which would largely sign up to public health goals of the kind that I've briefly sketched. But the more interesting group is the one that John also mentioned, the group that we think of as largely businesses, food and drink companies, and the rest. Now, the important point that I just want to end with here is that although, of course, businesses are run by people and employ and deal with people and so on, the business itself is not a moral agent. So the kind of constraint, anxiety that we have and that which we wish to protect again with respect to coercive interventions, those anxieties don't apply in the same way with respect to businesses. There is no moral or political, well, maybe political, but there's no moral or ethical objection to the state being much more forceful in regulating businesses than it is with respect to individuals. Businesses are not moral agents in the same sense in which individuals are. Now, of course, businesses do have a corporate, well, they may well sign up for corporate social responsibility. And if they do so, and then take on board public health goals, all to the good. But experience again suggests that voluntary codes are not enthusiastically grasped or implemented in quite the way that would fulfill the stewardship role of the state. So as you'll see with our recommendations, we do take it that there's good grounds for the state to intervene rather more forcefully with respect to businesses than has been the case up to now. Okay, I should stop that. Now, I think I take some questions, don't I? 2 or 3 minutes.